Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On Steampunk. For more information and news we talk about in our show, go to our website at www.geekson.com. All right, everybody, we are back here. Another fine episode of Geeks On.
An extra large, steamy episode of Geeks On.
Yes, we have lots of people
in our multi-million dollar studio.
In our multi-million dollar studio here. So why don't we just get to introductions real quickly. We'll start here with Matt.
Hi, I am Matt King. I am an actor here in Los Angeles, and I am a geek.
Hi, my name is Aaron Hendricks, and I'm a graphic designer here in Los Angeles, and I am a geek.
Hi, my name is Peter Robinson, and I'm a screenwriter here in Los Angeles, and I am a geek.
And remotely,
Cheyenne.
Hi, my name is Cheyenne Wright. I'm an illustrator in Seattle, Washington, and I am a geek.
Evelyn?
You don't have to be a geek if you don't want to, Evelyn.
My name is Evelyn Crete, and I guess I'm an honorary geek?
No, you can be a full geek if you want to be. Evelyn, tell us what you do.
G.D. Folkson. I'm an author and a lecturer, and I am in extremely good company, let me tell you.
Nice.
I am very privileged to be here.
You're not going to be lecturing me all night, are you?
Only if you want me to.
Okay.
I only lecture on request.
Okay, perfect.
Excellent.
Well, we have this crazy cast because we are going to be talking about steampunk a little bit later.
Yeah,
well. And these are some
extremely
experts.
Steampunky people.
Yes. I'm actually going to be quiet along a lot of this because
Sure.
Well, I'll try to be quiet.
Note because my skeptical look.
I'm not as versed on the steampunk universe as all y'all.
We can fix that.
All right.
Yes.
That's the whole purpose of this episode.
Exactly.
By the end of this, we'll all be experts.
But first, before we get into that, did anybody have an interesting geek week?
I had a very steampunky geek week.
Okay.
Because the release of The World of Steam. We brought out the World of Steam with Evelyn's help and GD's help and Cheyenne's help and your help, Aaron.
And explain to us what the World of Steam is, Matt.
The World of Steam is a set of Twilight Zone-like episodes set in a steampunk universe. And we are going wide and seeking funding on Kickstarter. And we got a bunch of attention, due in no small part to Evelyn and GD and Cheyenne and yourself and everybody else who I owe favors to.
You owe me your soul.
Yes, my soul. Damn it.
Kidding.
That sounds like one of the episodes.
Yeah, exactly. Kidding, not kidding. We came out wide. Wired magazine picked stuff on the second day.
So this is your Kickstarter project.
It's our Kickstarter project, yeah. Grant Imahara of Mythbusters came out and did a huge tweet for us. And then today, Marissa Tancher and Whedon, Jed Whedon's wife and writer of Dr. Horrible's online blog, she tweeted us out this morning to her fans. And then as of 7 p.m. this evening, Felicia Day tweeted us out to her 2 million followers. And so it's been raining money for the last few hours, which is freaking awesome.
It's up to 27.
Wow.
So
you got a lot of tweets going on.
Got a lot of tweets going on, and the show's been getting good notice because of it, so can't complain.
Excellent. Anything else geeky for you this week?
I've been living that for I got to work with Alfred Molina on a new David E. Kelly pilot called Monday Mornings, and it was Alfred Molina and Ving Rhames and Bill Irwin. He's a Broadway star. I used to usher for him, and so but it was so hard. I met Molina, and I'm like sitting there and. So hard not to go, like, you throw me the idol, I'll throw you the whip. Just like every time I'm looking at him, that's all I'm thinking.
Right.
Like the whole time.
Oh, that's going to be on his tombstone.
Yes, it is.
I just wanted to say, this is not a review or anything, but it's taken me this long to actually finish the video game Mass Effect. I don't know if anybody out there.
You mean three?
Mass Effect 3.
Well, that's okay. I'm still behind you. I still haven't played
well,
it.
Well, you know, I waited until this download where they fixed the ending.
Right.
So I played the whole thing. I thought it was a great freaking ending to the the trilogy. And I'm not sure exactly how bad the original ending was, but I thought this was fine. And it's
a very adult ending.
Yeah.
Like, it's not
you
all
like
rose.
You like killing.
I don't like just rosy endings.
No, you like kill the hero.
I like everyone dead. If you have not played Mass Effect 3 because of the bad reviews of the bad ending, I think that was a. I think the internet just got a little worked up.
Well, because I heard that the third ending was just they didn't. It was sudden, and they didn't really resolve anything. But I don't know. I'm completely talking on my ass, so I'm going
to I don't know. I'll look up to see what the original ending was. But anyway, if you haven't finished up the series of Mass Effect, it's a great science fiction story.
Okay.
And worth the three trilogies, which is like 100 hours worth of gameplay, if you've got the time. All right, Peter?
I just saw Seven Psychopaths last night.
Oh,
what'd you think? It was great. It was a lot of fun. It's totally an unusual movie. It's kind of it breaks a lot of the standard narrative storytelling rules in a really great way.
Yes,
and I think it's really fun. I think people should see it.
Yeah, I thought Walken and Sam Rockwell both deserved supporting Oscars because
they're great.
They're astounding. Walken at one point says, like, somebody is like, hands up! And they're like, got a gun on him. And he's like, no.
He just does
in a complete, like, impersonation of himself on one line. The word no. And it's hilarious. No.
He's kind of an amazing guy.
Yeah. Cheyenne, how about your Geek Week?
Well, let's see. This week's started with me hosting an airship regatta at a steampunk convention here in Seattle.
Wow.
Okay, now, are they actually airships? Do you guys actually float stuff?
Well, we take a helium balloon and some funny animal balloons, and we make a little cage for the funny animal balloons so it kind of looks like the ribbing on the side of an airship.
Okay.
And they have to race them through an obstacle course of hula hoops that we have people holding using just, you know, handheld fans.
And, oh, that's funny.
That's hilarious.
It's a lot of fun. We ran three heats, and then the winner of each heat all went into a final race. And the time of their final race is added to their race, added to their time from the first heat, and then the winner got silver. The guy, copper, silver, or gold medals based on how they placed. It was a lot of fun.
I would think that you would want to get that remote-controlled shark.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
I was looking into that. I wanted because I play really, you know, dramatic music during the airship regatta, and I just wanted to at one point during, like, the third heat, just have the Jaws theme come on, and I just start flying a remote-controlled shark out. But it's just, by the time I thought of getting it, it was just too close to the convention time for me to order it and actually come to it, the convention, with the understanding of how to make it work the way I wanted it to. If I would have gotten it, it would have been like just under the wire, and I wouldn't necessarily have known how to use it at the thing. So, so that was the start of my week, and the rest of my week has been doing illustrations for various games, and then the November 1st was my wedding anniversary, and so.
Happy Geeky Wedding.
Well, thank you very much. And so we and my wife and I busted out our wedding gift, our wedding anniversary present to each other, and played with that last night, which was we started assembling a Lego haunted house.
Wow. You had an extremely geeky week.
That's a really geeky week. What about you, Evelyn? You were just underwater, right?
Oh, well, my last week, my Halloween costume was a hurricane survivor. I'm trying to think. And I got lucky. The only thing that happened was a 400-pound branch fell in the road, knocked live wires in the road, didn't damage my house, but damaged all the other houses around my neighborhood. And I don't think this is very geeky. I just think this is what happened around here.
Yeah, you were on the coast that got...
You got geschmacked.
Yeah. They canceled Halloween. No, they didn't, because the kids are still trick-or-treating. Now, last weekend, I did styling for a photo booth at a New York event, the Macabre Masquerade, run by Gemini Scorpio. And that was crazy. We had fire spinners and all sorts of live acts. And that party went from, like, 8 p.m. to like 6 a.m. And there's nothing like being on the subway at 6 a.m. Halloween weekend and watching the parade of like half disheveled costumes and whatever walk through like zombies. Seriously, it's like, and then when you walk through like the subways, it's like there's Halloween rapture, so there's like costumes spread all over the place from people who are home from the whatever, so they just like, you know, flapper feathers and random just costume bits all over the place, which is what most of the subways look. And if you go through Penn Station, it's worse. I mean, I'd love to know what the janitors come home with that weekend.
Conventions.
No, this isn't a convention. This is New York.
Oh. Yeah, Halloween in New York. It's a crazy thing.
Halloween, New York Halloween weekend is, I guess, a giant convention.
I miss doing the Halloween parade in New York, man. That's some of the most fun I've ever had.
Those are crazy, and I think the hurricane screwed that up this year, but most people celebrated Halloween the weekend before, so... The only interesting thing about this Halloween is, have you noticed now there is officially a sexy version of everything?
Yeah,
literally everything.
Literally everything. I saw a sexy watermelon costume.
Thank God.
Sesame Street was having a big problem because there was a sexy Big Bird costume.
Yes, and I saw that costume walking down Times Square. And there's a sexy Oscar. There was a group of them. I didn't get a picture of them. It was a sexy Oscar, a sexy Big Bird, and I think the girl was a sexy Elmo.
A sexy Elmo.
So a sexy Oscar would truly be trashy.
Yeah.
Oh.
Literally, there is this Halloween, I have officially proven that there is a sexy version of everything.
Wow.
When I saw the sexy watermelon walk by, I was just like, really?
Juicy.
You know, but New York must be like the most awesome place to go for Halloween. I mean, this must be the best costumes ever, you know?
Yes and no. You get like amazing, crazy stuff, and then you get the guy who took tin foil and decided to wrap himself in it and say that he was a knight.
Yeah, well, that guy
did that.
I know, but I was a leftover. There's a big difference.
Or a burrito.
Right. What about you, GD?
Because of the hurricane, I didn't have anything particularly exciting or geeky going on this week, aside from, you know, power outages and all that. I will tell you, though, this month, I'm very excited this month, my next novel, The Ouroboros Cycle, A Monster's Coming of Age Story, is is coming out, and I'm very, very happy about this. It's something I've been working on for about 10 years.
Wow, congratulations.
It's actually the setting that got me into seriously pursuing a writing career. And part of the reason why I'm so excited, it is a paranormal adventure story set in the second half of the Victorian period. It has vampires, which I think is just absolutely lots of fun. And it is my personal attempt to help bring back the illustrated novel. It's fully illustrated. There's an illustration for each chapter.
Cool.
I am so excited to be doing this because I really think that we need more illustrated novels. We had them like all the way into like 40s or 50s, and then boom, they disappeared. And I'm so sad about that. And then in the next 2 weeks, next week or two, I'm launching a Kickstarter to try and help promote the concept of the illustrated novel.
Great.
Did that disappear because of cost?
Yes.
It's the cost of art because you have to pay artists, and you know, obviously standard of living costs go up, so therefore what artists need to charge goes up, and you're already paying a bunch of money for the covers. I mean, if you look at, go into a bookstore, you look at, you know, a bunch of the covers for fiction books on the shelf, they're not even, you know, drawings or paintings anymore. It's clip art,
yeah.
You know, because the industry is hurting for money. So, you know, and it's really a tragic thing. But I think it is such a beautiful thing when you actually do have real art covers and you do have illustrations in there. You know, I think it's a beautiful thing. And I really want to try and encourage people to support that.
So do you have, like, I have a very old Robin Hood, which is one of my prized possessions, and it has these sort of beautiful color pages inside it that refer to like specific lines and specific moments in the book. Do you have that, or is it just specifically the chapter headings?
The chapter headings, what it is, each chap, and part formatting issue because you'd have to include the line of text as part of the image plate. And you know, then you have sizing issues. So basically what it is, it's a single image before each chapter, and it's showing a significant aspect of what happened in that
Wonderful.
Chapter.
Very cool. Well, yeah, congratulations. Birthing another novel.
After 10 years, man. Wow. What's it called again, GD, so everybody can go out and get it?
The setting is the Ouroboros cycle. This particular one is a monster's coming-of-age story. And then the sequel, which is coming out in a year, is a cautionary tale for young vampires.
Awesome.
We'll put the link to that on our website.
Cautionary tale for young vampires. I love that.
How about news?
How about news? What you got?
Well, the only thing I have is the thing I think probably the biggest geeky thing that happened this week, which was Disney buying Lucasfilms.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask everybody.
We got to do a whole show on this.
Well, I guess so. I just want to know what people think, because at first my geek knee jerked and I flinched. And then I kind of just was okay with it and even kind of excited about it in a way.
I wasn't excited about it. I have my thing with George Lucas where I have a problem with episodes 1, 2, and 3. That being said, I've come around to understand he's an artist. He does what he does. He's not beholden to anyone else.
He's an independent filmmaker.
He's a billionaire independent filmmaker. And the fact that then he said, I want a company which has shown that they protect a property, you know, and that they've protected a property for years and years and years and years and years. And it's not like he's not
to the,
had
to
this,
the detriment of
yeah,
society.
To, right. But, well, that's arguable. But he has had a relationship with Disney for years, with Star Tours and with any yeah. number of other things. And it's not like they're not already cute little toys.
The worst that could happen would mean that nothing would change.
Yeah, the worst thing that would happen would be that there would be better movies coming out. But, I mean, the thing was, I still, again, had the same flinch response you did until I found out that he donated all of the $4 billion to his educational charity.
Well,
at which point in time, I was like, he gets a walk.
Well, you know what it is? He's thinking about his legacy now.
Right.
I mean, he's already established his artistic, you know, Star Wars is never going to go away. And one of the reasons why I think he did the $4 billion donation was, first of all, it's fantastic. But second of all, he's more considering what are people going to think about him in 30 years. And the best way to establish your legacy is to do something like that, which is to donate, you know, the $4 billion to something that's going to help people for the next...
His educational fund is already incredible. Yeah. I mean, he did that whole wing at USC he's already stated that education is his main thing. And he says it's the main reason why we got out of the caves in the first place. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if he wants to make 17 more films just about Jar Jar, because he's going to be still the...
No, I totally agree.
I'm okay with it now. Because,
I'm okay.
I agree. This is the single biggest piece of art benefit to the human race that's happened. The $4 billion piece of art.
I agree.
That's crazy. I can't even wrap my head around it.
Would you go get a Jar Jar Binks tattoo in honor of George Lucas right now?
Let me think. No.
How dare you? Think of the children.
You hypocrite.
Yeah, exactly.
Think of the children. No, actually, I'll tell you, I'm very excited about it myself. And the reason is that Disney has done a really good job recently of doing films that are, you know, based on pre-existing source material.
Yeah, the Marvel thing.
Yeah, Marvel's been great. And I got to the Jaron Carter film. I love that. I thought that was
Did
fantastic.
You really?
Yeah,
I watched that on a flight, and I know Lynn Collins, who played the female lead in that, and I winced my way through it. I just winced my way all the way through that film.
But don't you think Disney's been pretty good about just staying out of, like, Marvel's way?
Yes, yes. From what I heard, that's exactly...
I mean, it's not like they did anything. It's like the best thing that Disney did was just buy it and then stay the F away.
What I've heard is there was someone over at Marvel who's kind of been shepherding all these projects who's amazing. You know, there's one guy who's kind of...
Yeah. And they have a woman who's shepherding Star Wars. In fact, she was there.
Yeah. Carolyn Kennedy? No, Carolyn, I don't know.
I can't remember. But maybe she...
Kathleen Kennedy. Kennedy.
Yeah, maybe she'll do the same thing, kind of, you know, well, direct it correctly.
He's worked with her on everything, and she's done some... What has Kathleen Kennedy done? I'll find it out. You guys keep on talking.
Well, I just wanted to bring that up. You know, I thought it was, when I first heard that, I assumed that I would hate this idea, but it really, it doesn't bother me at all.
No, it doesn't bother me at all either. Well, especially because, look, here's the thing. It's not like they're taking a project that has been done so extremely well in recent history
mm-hmm.
that you're like, oh my gosh, they're going to destroy it. We kind of feel like, I mean, you know, the last three were not the best.
That's putting it mildly.
Right. So, you know, I mean, you all you can do is hope that they can do something better and mm-hmm. maybe it'll bring it back to the thing we love.
So. Right.
Yeah. Okay. So she produced Schindler's List, The Sixth Sense, Back to the Future, Jurassic Park, Indiana Jones, all of the Star Wars movies, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Munich. Yeah. She's okay.
Yeah. We're right
AI.
Here.
Yeah. I think she can do a movie that's big.
All right.
Jeez. What's going to be interesting is no matter what, there's going to be nerd rage on the internet for casting.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely.
Tell me they're not going to have character that Luke and those guys are not in this.
I've been reading online that they've talked to the original actors
yeah.
about trying to have them come back and yep. do cameos and whatnot, but this is all like in the last week and the
I'd be okay with cameos, so but I don't want
true or not.
He's got
I noticed the day afterwards there's a huge Twitter movement to try and get Nathan Fillion named as the next Han Solo, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be something that takes place after everyone's dead and gone. It's the next generation of Star Trek or Star Wars, whatever.
The interesting thing is I know some from sort of a little bit of inside baseball that he has sketched out and he's had sketched out since 1970
bullshit
episodes. Actually not, but episodes through 12, right?
Yeah, because he sketched out 1 through 3 in that timeline.
Well, that was always the legend, yeah.
Right? You'd be surprised. There's a difference between sketched out
and fleshed out.
And fleshed out. Yeah, big difference. But supposedly 7, 8, and 9 are sort of the most action-intense films and the most action-intense plot lines that he has, and it's basically Luke at age 40. Now, Mark Hamill is older than that,
mm-hmm.
and so what some of the inside baseball that I heard
anyway?
Was that they might have
like
been doing...
Like in his 50s at this point?
Yeah, he's like 50-some, and he yeah. looks like he got run over by something heavy.
yeah.
But, you know, God bless him,
makeup?
He's so effing talented, but yeah, he doesn't
look... He was in that terrible car accident, so yeah.
Yes,
it shows.
He does not look like he's kept up well. But, they were thinking that they might be able to do something with him like they did with Bridges in Tron, is really youthing him up using CG. So,
oh, wow.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Mark Hamill accidentally kicked me at Comic-Con 2 years ago.
Yeah, and you've never forgiven him?
They could just do the full circle and put Luke in some sort of full-body thing and just have him do his own voice.
Yeah.
But have a different actor acting, you know, like put him in the next generation. Darth Vader outfit.
Yes. Oh.
By Mark Hamill.
Good. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I've got a little piece of news, which is that Japan Sharp, which is a major supplier of LCD displays to Apple and other manufacturers, has warned that it may not survive if it can't turn around its business. So, you know, it's hoping to be able to do that. But what's interesting about this is that I believe it was Motorola recently told Apple that they're ending their relationship with Apple in terms of supplying displays to them as well. So this is a big problem for Apple. It's a huge problem.
And their display right now, their new Apple Mini costs more than anything else of comparable size. Mm. And it's got a worse screen display. It's got a worse processor, and it costs twice as much. It's just bizarre.
What are you talking about?
I actually saw a price breakdown of Google's Nexus and the Amazon Kindle and the iPad. And whereas the Amazon has publicly said that they lose money on every Kindle they sell on the device itself, because then they don't mind that because they're going to make it back in sales of stuff over the Amazon website.
I mean,
I think the profit margin for the Nexus, which is Google's 7-inch handset, is like $50 or $100 if you get the extra 8 gigabytes added on. And but the profit margin for the iPad Mini is something like, you know, four times that.
Wow.
But you know, but like you said, you know, Amazon makes money every time you buy something on Amazon. If they have another device that is easily like a little mini catalog, which is kind of what it is.
Yeah.
The more you buy on something, the more money they make. And the same thing with Google, really. I mean, Google makes money with you just being on the internet. I mean, if you're searching and doing anything on there, Google is getting paid. So the more, you know, their devices are shuttling through their searches and all that, they're actually making money that way. And Apple makes money off the hardware.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, but it's strange that, you know, that money, like, why aren't they making money?
Right.
I mean, there's an F ton of tablets being sold. So
why isn't Sharp making money?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that that's not the only thing they make. They make a lot of things.
Okay.
And so the problem becomes if they're doing really well in one area, like the tablets and stuff, they can still be losing a shit ton of money by not selling TVs and other products that they're making.
Right.
That they spend
their
a lot of
stock
time
took a money. Dip when the iPad Mini debuted. Mm-hmm. I know they were surprised by that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is funny because all the other tablets make money when those announcements. When Apple makes an announcement like the Mini, Amazon and Kindle, their sales also go up. Yep. It's like people kind of get. They say, "Well, that's not what I want. That's not what I wanted."
Yeah,
people
wait until they hear the Apple announcement, they're disappointed, or you know, or think they're going to be disappointed, they go, "Oh well, I'm just going to go get this thing now, and it's cheaper."
Although
it's the
when
same
I did
thing.
See that the Apple Mini was so overpriced for what it actually delivered compared to comparable tablets, I really felt like I was remembering what Peter was talking about in terms of the ads of Apple and how they sort of signified a real post-Jobsian Apple that really didn't have the vision.
Apples have always been overpriced.
Yeah, no,
they've always been overpriced, but they also always provided the top of the line material.
I would argue but that as an experience that Mini is probably better than the other tablets.
Probably. Yeah.
So yes, it may be
I would take an issue of about always providing the top of line material. I own an iPad too, and I know that it's not made for taking pictures with, but it is. They do have all this video editing software on it, and I can't understand why they can't put something like a good camera in it instead of some camera that was maybe available in cell phones 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I think, again, it comes down to exactly what you just said, is that that's not what people are using it for. If people have a camera, you know, they're reusing it most likely to do Skype, to talk to their parents, and, you know, that type of stuff. You know, if you want to take really good pictures, you don't buy an iPad to do it with. You know,
no,
I also, you know, I don't doubt the fact that there's some type of Apple timeline where they know they have to incrementally make improvements, and so they back off on stuff so in the iPad 4 they actually have something put in there.
Probably.
Yeah, I think that's probably what it is. Yeah.
But this is really interesting because, I mean, you know, in general, you know, we talked as Matt talked about said that they suddenly started changing their marketing strategy after Jobs died, which was dramatically different. Then they've had the sort of the fiasco with the new maps, and literally had one of their longtime one of the people that's been there forever just left the
company. He got fired.
Yeah,
but you know, it's not like Jobs didn't have. I mean, he released all sorts of absolute garbage.
Oh, I'm sure, but you know, but it's just that it's just interesting to watch what's going on and wonder what the future holds. And
yep. Apple is cleaning house and saying it's been a year. This is how we're going to run Apple now. We're getting rid of some of the people that, you know, that Jobs probably sheltered. And I think that the rumor is that what's his face is one of them. And so, you know, I don't
Interesting.
Know.
So you get a grace period. You get a mourning period where they weren't going to fire him.
Exactly. Yeah. And now Tim Cook is saying, this is how I'm running it, and I'm going to put my people in here now, which is what they should do because, you know, what was it that there was like the company Ford said that their company had just been stalled out because they kept like trying to outguess what the Ford what have
Toyota
Ford
do,
yeah, what would have Ford done, what, you know, and they just weren't innovating. And finally had this, they had to say, you know what, this is our company now, we need to innovate. It's not going to be, you know, what would Steve do?
Yeah,
because you're never gonna get that. So they need to create their own thing now. So I don't know. We'll see.
Should we do some more news or move
on to? One last thing that I actually just found absolutely fascinating. This is a guy named Alec Kingston. He's a scientist, and he comes up with this experiment that basically shows that they're trying to figure out why humans have eyes in the middle of their faces, right?
Okay.
And what we do with it. People will automatically look where other people are looking. Right. Other scientists have since found that gaze copying behavior among any other animals. They're birds, the goats, the dolphins. We copy, you know, we look where other people are looking.
Okay.
Right. It seems fairly obvious why we would do this. We get an easy clue about interesting information in the world around us. But what are we actually doing?
Right.
Right. So there are two competing answers. The obvious one is that we're naturally drawn to people's eyes. Okay. So we automatically register where they're looking. Right. Indeed, one part of the brain, the superior temporal sulcus, is involved in processing the direction of gazes.
Okay.
And the equally plausible alternative is that we're focused more broadly on faces, and the eyes just happen to be in the middle.
Okay.
Okay. So this guy basically is this guy Alan Kingston. He's of the we look at people because it helps us process information. He basically says, how do I come up with an experiment that allows me to test this hypothesis that I have?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, how do I find eyes that aren't in the center of the faces to testing? And his son, who's this 12-year-old geeky kid, says, why don't you use monsters? And so, and he was like, monsters? And the kid's like, yeah. And he goes and gets his Dungeons & Dragons monster manual.
Okay.
And he shows his dad all of these different pictures of monsters. And because you have things like the Beholder and Cyclops and all these different things, he thought it was genius, is that suddenly you have eyes that are in random places on the body, and it can prove whether or not we look at faces because we're getting this information, or we look at faces because we look at faces.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this fascinating study. We'll post it on the website, but really check it out. It's just fascinating. And this kid, who's a 12-year-old kid, he gets to be on his first scientific paper. He's the number one.
And the monster manual is being cited.
And the monster manual is being cited. It's fascinating.
That's one for the geeks.
Yes. one for the geeks.
Yeah.
Anybody else got anything really, really interesting?
Well, I ran across this news story about a company in Dallas that is trying to sue Wizards of the Coast for copyright infringement over Magic the Gathering.
Really?
What? The article, which is very brief, reads that this is over the Magic the Gathering Online video game version of Magic the Gathering, and they're in this company called Wildcat Intellectual Property Holdings is claiming that the Wizard is infringing on their copyrights for digital electronic game trading cards.
Whatever. This copyright thing is just out of control.
Yeah, there's some serious problems with copyright these days.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see how that's going to pan out.
That's ridiculous.
Now, did you guys hear about the somebody was murdered over Magic the Gathering cards recently?
What?
What?
Yeah. Seriously?
Yeah, it was like a brother killed
him. Well, where else? Florida.
Yes.
Wow.
It was like a brother killed another brother because of like a $300 or like a $30,000.
I think I heard $100,000 collection of Magic cards.
Yeah,
and I think it was two brothers killing somebody else who had it.
Oh my God,
but, that's me pulling the story out of the back of my head.
Yeah, me too. I kind of casually heard it, and I was just like, "Come on, it's up there with the." Remember the guy beat the other person because he traded his some Warcraft sword that was worth money, so the guy just beat him to death.
Well, I don't know.
Wow.
It's like geek on geek.
collector things, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's the crazy thing. It's, you know, you notice it when it's with something like, you know, card games or video games or whatever. But that really is no different from someone being like, you know, I've got this, you know, old Civil War sword. It's a collector's item and I want to get it. The guy won't sell it to me, so I'm going to kill him and take it. Something like that. It's like any of that stuff.
Except for it's funnier.
Except for it's funnier because people are
yes,
like, you know.
It's a little more ludicrous like when it's, you know, sort of magical computer sword. But
yeah. There was a mentally challenged guy who had this huge Superman collection. I mean, he'd been collecting it for years. That was his thing. And this friend of his from his work found out that he had it and brought his girlfriend over to sort of distract him, and he ransacked the guy's house of all his Superman memorabilia. It turned out to be like a $75,000 collection that the guy had.
Wow.
You know?
That's just wrong on so many levels.
Such an internet shitstorm that they finally caught the guy and returned his collection to him. And stuff. But, yeah.
It's like, you know, you're stealing Magic the Gathering cards that are worth a lot of money. There's not that many places you can sell them. This is just, yeah. I mean, how can you not know this is a bad idea? You know? I mean,
people,
really, it's like,
people.
You know.
Let's say I just had a Black Lotus. Yeah.
And they're not going to get caught.
Where could I voice that?
So our topic this week, Matt?
Steampunk.
That's right. And you guys are going to have to take it away here.
All right, well, I mean, where do we think I think we should start with, frankly, a definition of steampunk.
Yeah.
Let's go to our panelists. Cheyenne, Evelyn, Gidi, anybody want to chime in on what is steampunk?
Yes.
Do your thing.
Yeah, I'm very used to this. Whenever I get brought to a convention, they always have me do this. So, very simply, steampunk is Victorian science fiction. And what I mean by that is Victorian is basically used as a keyword to signify the industrial 19th century. It's actually a slightly larger period of time than the Victorian era. It goes from about the beginning of the 19th century up through about the First World War. And it, of course, encompasses the entirety of the world. Any culture that existed in the 19th century has a valid place in steampunk. And what it does is it really explores the idea that you have the aesthetics and the fashions and the style and the ideas and, of course, the technology of the 19th century, this very highly advanced period. You know, it was the beginning of the modern world, basically, as far as technology was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And they then imagine, okay, well, what would it look like if it was slightly more advanced? And, of course, in the 19th century itself, you have science fiction authors. This is really the birth of modern science fiction. You know, you have people like H.G. Wells and Jules Verne and Albert Robida, basically imagining what the future is going to be like, you know, normal science fiction. And so what modern steampunk enthusiasts and authors and artists do is they basically look back and they say, well, we can't be in the 19th century and imagine what the future is going to look like, but we can say we know what the future looks like. What if the future looked like what they thought it would? And you know, you have the imagining of things that they never really could have predicted, such as, you know, full-scale telecommunications and the internet being translated into telegraph lines, aerial mass transit in ways that they never really imagined, but using the types of technology that they were already exploring. And one of the reasons why I think steampunk is so popular is that it very much sort of hits home. It resonates with us because the Victorian period, the 19th century, is extremely close to us in terms of technology, social structure, and even fashion, much closer to us than it was to really earlier periods. And what I mean by that is, you know, you have the growth of the modern sort of three-tiered social structure with a working class, a clerical middle class, and then a wealthy upper class. And that really is a product of the Industrial Revolution. You have the development of what you would identify as office culture or, you know, modern clerical class that didn't exist in prior periods because you just didn't have as much paper being pushed around. But, you know, now in the 19th century, with industrialization, with a whole freed up section of society, the white collar middle class, you've got this huge chunk of the population that's basically just moving numbers and words around on paper for people who have money. And it's really a fascinating thing. You know, in the 19th century, there was something called the pan telegraph, which was basically a fax machine. It was you'd use ink that you could pass the current through, and you would then have the machine translate the letters into the dots and dashes of telegraph code. And just, you know, when people look at that, they're like, oh, that's amazing. You know, so they had that. Well, what if they had this? What if, you know, you have analytical, you know, calculators, you have the analytical engine and then the difference engine, you know, being created, where you have these mechanical computers, basically, and they say, well, then, you know, what would it have been like if they'd been able to turn that into a computer revolution? That's the plot, for example, of the novel The Difference Engine. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it really is an astounding topic. I think that's part of the reason why it's so popular, because it does resonate with us. And also, it looks really nice.
It looks amazing, and that's actually what attracted me to it in the first place, was the design aesthetic. But do you think, or do any of you think of steampunk, is it, if the Matrix and cyberpunk is this alternate future, is steampunk an alternate past, or is it also an alternate future, or does it just depend on the author?
In the 19th century, or whether they're writing, whether they're setting it, I mean, in a post 19th century type of setting. So, to give you an example, you know, Jules Verne is writing, you know, in the 19th century. The Difference Engine by Gibson and Sterling is set in the 19th century. So these are alternative pasts. But you know, you look at S.M. Sterling's The Peshawar Lancers, and that's set in, you know, the early 21st century. But that never lost the aesthetic, majority of the technological structure of the 19th century. So that, in that case, is an alternate future from an alternate past.
Interesting.
It really is a huge topic, which I think is great.
Now, so, go ahead.
You had mentioned the reason why maybe now it is back in style. I mean, really, we've seen this the swell of steampunk lately, where, yeah, you know, like 60 Minutes, I think, or, you know, 2020.
You want to know all the media for it?
Why don't you?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot of it right now. And my dad called me up a month ago and said, have you heard of this steampunk thing? And I'm like, okay, well, if my dad has heard of that, then we're now...
Especially if your dad has heard of it.
Yeah. So why is it really swelling right now?
There's a couple of reasons why it's blowing up right now. Part of the reason is over the last, 10 years now, a couple of key people have been working to get it into the media so that the artists can make a living off of it. Mm. And also because it's an aesthetic, everything that's old becomes new eventually. Wait, did I say that?
Yes.
Everything that is old becomes new, and everything that's old becomes old and new and whatever. The long and short of it is, it looks good. It's a type of aesthetic that you can pretty much apply to anything. Mm-hmm. And there is no real doing it wrong, so a lot of people actually like to get into it because they... Unlike a lot of things where if they try to get into it, they're hit by this wall of, well, you have to do this, you have to do that, it has to look like this, it has to be exactly like that, or you don't get to play. This thing is big enough where pretty much anyone can find a place in it and have fun with it and not be told that whatever they're doing doesn't fit.
Now, you're specifically talking about the costuming.
Oh no, I'm talking about the fashion. I mean, I'm not a costumer. I am a fashion designer.
Okay.
Clothes for Gallery Serpentine, which is an Australian label. But I mean, steampunk is really an aesthetic movement that applies to fiction, fashion, video games, pretty much everything and anything. And that's the reason why you're seeing it go mainstream so fast, because every place can take it, apply the aesthetic to it, and bam, it fits. And that's why you have, like, Dishonored that came out this last, couple weeks ago?
Yeah.
The big Bethesda game. And then you're going to have the Bioshock 3 come out in the next couple of months. There's, like, a number of huge budget films coming out in the next 3 to 4 years, some of which I can't talk about. I have a lot of things that I could talk about here, but I'll get yelled at and maybe lose work from. So I can't. But in the next, 3 to 5 years to even, 8 years, there's going to be more and more stuff steampunk related showing up in the mainstream everything, because they all realize that it's, well, your dad knew what it was and your dad thought it was cute, right?
He thought it was very cool. He thought it was very cool looking.
Yeah. And that there you have the reason why it's blown up, because it, having run all the stuff that I have with the social media and everything, I can tell you that the demographic is like 12 to 65.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been to events and everything where I've seen like a 20 some odd year old sitting next to a 65 year old person, and because they're both into this thing, they get to hang out and talk and relate. It's really a broad enough topic where pretty much everybody likes it, and the companies like it because it's not hard to do. It's not a fad because it's going to be around for the next 15 years, and it has so many different possibilities of where you can go with it if you want to go with it, that it's really accessible.
Fantastic.
And now, I mean, there's an entire, and then the other reason why, and actually I'll have Falkson talk about this because he's better at it, the whole, the only way every generation rebels against the previous generation by dressing differently.
Yeah, so yeah, basically it's
that's a nice handoff.
So basically, yeah, one of the main ways that a younger generation rebels against the older generation is by becoming more casual. And you see this basically throughout the entire progression of the past like two centuries. More and more casual, each generation is doing that. And but there's a conundrum for the current generation, because we've gotten to the point in the past couple of decades where it's really hard to get more casual. You know, we went from frock coats to three-piece suits to two-piece suits. And, you know, nowadays, you know, even wearing a dress shirt and some khakis is a little strangely formal. You assume someone's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, T-shirt and jeans, which at one time not too long ago was very, very liberating. It was a way to show that you were an individual, you were nonconformist, et cetera, et cetera. Nowadays, it's the new standard. If someone isn't wearing very casual clothing, people wonder what's going on. They wonder if they're working, if they have a special event, that sort of thing. I walk around in, you know, suits, and people are always asking what I'm doing, and I just happen to like to wear them.
Right.
And so the way that the current generation is able to rebel against the previous generation is by going the opposite direction, by becoming more formal. Oh, and so in some respects, what you see with not only steampunk, but this whole general neo-vintage movement that's going on, which is, you know, steampunk with the Victorian stuff, the retro 20s, 30s stuff as well, the rockabilly type things in the 50s, whole range of things. It's a way for people basically to say, no, I'm going to be an individual and look completely different from mainstream society.
Hmm.
But I think that what's so great about it is the way they do that is by becoming more formal, more genteel, more polite, by having tea parties and playing croquet, which is just absolutely wonderful. So I think it's a really great rebellion. And I think it's
a softer rebellion, just, as it were.
Well, maybe I asked Cheyenne this at Comic-Con, because somebody asked me this. They didn't understand why it was steampunk, where the punk part came in. And Cheyenne, you had some alternate names, but maybe this rebellion is part of the punk part.
Well, the punk in steampunk was a joke. That was that whole name was just a off the cuff thing in a letter that Jeter.
Yeah, wrote to Locus. Yeah.
Yeah.
And basically what it is the reason why it's called steampunk is Jeter was referencing the fact that he and the other authors were, you know, had predominantly written cyberpunk, which was the big, you know, sort of dominant popular genre of the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then they tried their hand at writing these Victorian, these steam age stories. And when this reviewer basically reviewed a bunch of their different stories and noted the fact there was clearly something common going on, because they're all, you know, set in the Victorian era, but they're all science fiction. But they're obviously not cyberpunk, because cyberpunk is near future. And Jeter wrote this letter to them, you know, basically sort of, you know, tongue-in-cheek jokingly saying, well, you know, yeah, we clearly need a name for it. There's something going on. Well, it's not cyberpunk. Maybe it's steampunk. And
Cheyenne?
Like most things that are done off the cuff, it has caused a world of confusion. No. But, you know, people see that and they're like, oh, steampunk. So is that related to the punk subculture, punk rock, something like that? And of course it isn't. It's completely unrelated. And then you have people who, you know, try to find explanations for it, like, oh, well, it's because you're messing around with history, that sort of thing. And that's not the case. It really is just a word that's, you know, that Jeter came up with on the fly to describe what the genre was.
So what were your alternates, Cheyenne?
Matt, you know,
Cheyenne had some.
When we launched Girl Genius 12 years ago, we were searching for a way to describe it that wasn't going to be stepping on anybody's toes. There was, at the time, a somewhat incomprehensible comic book called Steampunk. And while we knew that the steampunk word existed, we didn't want to necessarily try and say we were connecting ourselves to this book. And we searched for a term that we felt would convey the same sort of feeling but would be divorced from the punk moniker, because there was nothing punkish about Girl Genius. And so we settled on a term that we call, to this day, Gaslamp Fantasy.
It's great.
Yeah.
I like that.
What other ones? You said you had, Aaron said you had other, I don't know if he's right.
I thought you had a couple, but maybe that was just a.
Well, no, I think that was the one we settled on. I think there was a few others. We used to sit around the office and pitch all sorts of different variations at the time, but we liked it. We had settled on Gaslamp Fantasy as the term that we were going for. There are other what are now called subgenres of steampunk that you can find out there, but neither of them are necessarily punk either.
None of it's punk.
Yeah.
The funny thing about Jeter is, Matt, you know that Jeter actually supported the World of Steam Kickstarter, right?
He did? That's awesome.
Yeah, he did. He was like, this first day, he emailed me, and he's like, yeah, I bought one of the rewards. You'll see what it is when it gets funded. But yeah, Jeter loves the project.
That's a nice little stamp.
He bought one of the rewards.
That's wonderful.
Very cool.
He's a good egg.
Remind me to give him a hug.
So if somebody, somebody's listening to this podcast and they want to get into this, they want to watch some movies, they want to read some books, and they want to learn about how to dress, you know, in this cool look. Where should they start looking for this stuff?
Okay, movies. Top five movies I would suggest watching, and everybody else can give their top five movies, because then that means they'll get maybe a different top five.
Don't say Wild Wild West.
You want to see a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I know it was nothing like the comic, but it's a good. No, I know. They're two different things. Like, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is a fantastic comic to read, too.
Yeah,
Alan Moore is awesome. But they're, you know, it's one of those things where just completely divorce your mind that it's going to be like the comic and you'll enjoy it.
Okay.
And it is a beautiful example of a steampunk film. Another beautiful example of a steampunk film that I know I'm going to get groans from, but it is a fun film, Wild Wild West.
It is a very good example.
It's fun.
It suffers
there
from
is
being
so much
late
scenery
90s.
Being chewed That's in that thing. Film, it almost doesn't make it off the screen.
Another really good film, it's a French film, and I'm going to butcher the title of it, and Falkson will probably correct me, because he knows what I'm talking about.
Do you mean Vidocq?
Vidocq, yeah, there you go. That's another fantastic film that's very little known over here, but it's another beautiful example of a steampunk film, so I got three. City of the Lost Children. It's another brilliant example of a steampunk-type aesthetic.
Now, have you guys noticed that the new Sherlock Holmes movies have a steampunk ish?
Completely on accident. Actually, there was an interview with the director after the first one, which is another good example if you want to see a steampunk type film, where he was asked, so what made you think, I'm paraphrasing, what made you decide to go in a steampunk direction with the Sherlock Holmes films? And he had to actually look it up because he'd never heard of it before. And then actually, apparently, I've heard, now this might not be true, that after the first film came out, he actually looked it up and then applied some stuff to the second film because it was such a thing that constantly got brought up with him in interviews.
So what's your fifth film?
It's an anime, but it's one of the best steampunk anime films I've ever seen. The title really does give it away. Steam Boy?
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic.
Marvel.
And the dub on that is actually really good, too. But those are, like, the top five. If you want to get a good idea of what the aesthetic looks like and everything, those are the five I'd suggest.
Did you guys ever... There was, I think it's called Robot Carnival, which was a anime that had, like, five or six short films. But one of them was, like, this old Japanese...
Yeah.
And they'd built mechs using just... cannonballs and people with pulleys.
It was cool.
It was very cool, and that was definitely kind of a steampunk.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
remember
it's
that.
A Japanese flavored steampunk, but it's very cool.
What about you, Cheyenne?
Let's see, movies that I would recommend with a steampunk aesthetic.
Or books or
there
comics.
It didn't do very well. There's a film that came out with Nicole Kidman. It was trying to capture the same sort of crowd as the Harry Potter kids. And it was based on this girl who had the Magic Compass, I believe was the name
of
it.
The Golden Compass.
Golden Compass.
Yeah. Right.
I threw my shoes at the screen because it's
It's got some great, beautiful visuals of golden airships and some really nice looks to it. We're just talking about from a design sense.
It sounds like
I would also
no
say that anything
good...
that any of the great historical science fictions that Disney did in the 60s, are a fine example. I mean, we're talking, any of the Jules Verne movies that they produced, Time Machine and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea with its giant sea kraken and stuff like
that.
That's
Kraken, man. It's
that's
awesome.
That's all steampunk, authentic steampunk. And
those were good movies.
One of the things that I find so funny when I'm at a party or something like that, and people find out what I do, and they're like, "Oh, steampunk! I've heard about that. So how much longer do you think that thing's going to be around?" And I go, "Well, we're just reusing stuff that's been around for 100 years. It's not gone away. That's why you see such a wide range of age groups that are the people who enjoy steampunk. The steampunk convention that I was just at, we have little kids running around in vests and bowler hats, and 70-year-old men dressed exactly the same, all enjoying the thing because." Those 70-year-old men, they grew up with exactly this science fiction.
Oh, you guys will be into carburetor punk in another 5 years.
Yeah.
Well, there is
diesel punk.
Diesel punk.
Diesel
punk. There is
Pulp.
Diesel punk. Which
Pulp
is...
Adventure. Actually, I was saying, on the topic of the the late mid-late 20th century films, there's a very enjoyable, if low-budget, version of Jules Verne's Master of the World starring Vincent Price as Robert, which is just absolutely wonderful. I think that's by American International Films or something like that. It's a low budget late 60s film, but it's so wonderful. And Vincent Price is just like Vincent Price is amazing in it.
Mm-hmm. It's about a guy who wants to build an airship that he can use to overtake the America, right?
No, he's going to destroy the militaries of the world, and he destroys the British fleet because, of course, they're the most powerful force in the world. But the whole thing is he's going to sort of force the world to demilitarize, disarm, with this super powerful warship and then flying warship, and then these sort of this scrappy American who is on board goes and stops him, but it's a lot of fun. Yeah, and like I said, absolutely, the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and the other Disney films.
Didn't
I would
Sci-Fi
definitely
Channel
want to give
mini-
Steam Boy another big push after Evelyn brought it up, because I would argue it is one of, not just one of the best animes, but it is one of the best films, period, for steampunk, because it just so wonderfully melds the aesthetics of the period with all the mundane stuff with the very advanced technology. Like, they've got, steam-powered cars, which are basically structured like trains. It's just that they can go off rails. And it's just, it's very, very well composed.
Hmm. Would you guys...
Let me think here. There's actually a TV show, a great TV show, that's basically impossible to find from the mid-90s. It was a UPN show called Legend. And it was this wonderful example of steampunk Wild West. With Richard Dean Anderson and John Delancey, I think it was. John Delancey being a Hungarian mad scientist who is very thinly veiled Nikola Tesla.
I remember
and
that.
It only had one season. It's a wonderful show, and it's not on DVD anywhere. It's all you can do is see if someone recorded it on VHS back when it was on TV. And it's such a shame because it was such a wonderful show.
Wasn't there a sci-fi? Oh. Wasn't Riverworld a sci-fi channel miniseries or something?
Something like that, but that's more fantasy.
Is it?
That doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. Would you say
there was Riverworld takes place in sort of a alternate post-death universe, but it involves a bunch of people on a riverboat along with Mark Twain, you know, traveling up the river, which is this world where everyone comes to when they die. So,
I would love to meet Mark Twain when I die. I think I'd be happy with that.
All right, so it's not quite steampunk.
So BioShock, is that?
But you know, the Adventures of Briscoe County, if you want to talk about television series that have steampunk aesthetics in it. Or even going back to one of my favorite early steampunk television shows, Voyagers.
Voyagers. Oh, man. With the green light and the red light. Changing time.
Yeah.
Would you guys say that BioShock, is that steampunk or diesel punk?
BioShock 1 and 2 are pulp.
Yeah, it's then ghost style.
Pulp.
But the third one, BioShock Infinite, that's actually... Just from the trailers I've seen, that's a wonderful example of steampunk. They really look like they nailed it.
And that's coming out next year, I believe.
So, probably next year.
Yeah, Dishonored came out. I'm trying to think of other steampunk video games.
There was, back in the 90s, there was this RPG called Arcanum, which was obviously it's very dated now, but the concept was great. And it was basically the idea that it's a classic... you know, Tolkien-esque, you know, high fantasy setting that has an industrial revolution. So you've got dwarves and elves and orcs and all that, but the styles are Victorian. You have railroads, you know, you have, you know, factories and steam engines and all that. And the thing that I really like about it is, first of all, it's one of the only times I've actually seen a very successful melding of this sort of fantasy magic with steampunk. It's very hard to do that because there's the friction of the fantasy versus the sci-fi, the hard science. But it does it very well. And the way it does it is the idea that magic is essentially dying because of this development of an age of reason. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of polarizing effects with that. But it's very well done. But, you know, from the 90s, it's almost impossible to find.
There's a great video game called Torchlight.
Yeah, okay.
Which is sort of a Diablo clone, but it's got a heavy steampunk influences in the armor and whatnot that you can wear, and there's a couple classes of characters that you can play that actually build little steam-powered robots.
Oh, huh.
That's fun.
I think I have Torchlight. Didn't get that theme.
It might be the second one.
Huh. This one does. The first one's very much sort of standard fantasy, but the second one, yeah, that's right. I remember reading about that. They've got like an engineer character.
Let me jump off on that little fantasy kick there, is because we've talked a little bit about the sort of machine aesthetic of steampunk, but there is this Lovecraftian horror / fantasy aspect of the things that cannot be named and the powers that be. What fiction
would roll around if he thought his stuff was getting thrown into steampunk, because he fought so hard to have his own genre, but he's gotten lumped into steampunk in the last, like, what, 2-3 years?
I think the big reason for that is just people who like steampunk also like Lovecraftian weird fiction.
So they're meshing.
There isn't an inherent connection between the two. They're okay. Two distinct genres. But I think there's definitely a lot of interest crossover. And I've got to say, well done Lovecraftian steampunk, basically actual steampunk setting but borrowing themes from Lovecraft, can be really phenomenally done. Victorian Lovecraft is very, very creepy. I'm trying to think if there's a good example of that. You know, actually, I'll tell you, I never played it, but I saw a few years ago there was one of these, you know, sort of adventure Sherlock Holmes games. I think it was a series of them. And they had one where Sherlock Holmes was in a mythos setting, and he was going after these Cthulhu cultists. And I'm actually really sad I never got to see it played, because it was a great concept. You know? But that's the kind of crossover I think you'd see with that sort of thing.
Huh. I know that there are some very few board games out there. Red Planet, I believe, is one of them. And on Kickstarter right now, there's like 10.
Oh, yeah, there's ridiculous numbers. I actually I went and I got these... when I was looking at Kickstarters, just to sort of explore how you do this Kickstarter thing, and I started funding a bunch of them, there was just this really interesting, like, gaming cards that are like Magic the Gathering cards, and you can get a deck, and I got one of the decks of them.
Steampunk themed,
and there's another one that's I just thought it was such a wonderful concept. It's all about robots gone wild, and you're recovering all of the steampunk crazy robots gone wild. And it's just not like they pull up their shirts gone wild, but you know the other they're going to kill people gone wild.
Yeah, you know there's not a whole lot of board games right now, but they're starting to show up, for sure.
It's awesome. So now you guys are some of the progenitors of the modern inception of steampunk. Where have you guys? How have you helped push it along? Push along the steampunk movement, and where do you see it going in the next couple of years?
Well, I want to go on record, and I don't want to say I apologize for it, because I'll still stand by the decision to this day. But I probably am responsible for all the goggles.
You.
That's me. Yeah.
So, you.
Is that you, Cheyenne? You're the goggle guy.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Back when we were this is 12 years ago, back when we were getting Girl Genius off the ground, we were doing a whole bunch of science fiction conventions, and we only had like one or two comics out, and we had a whole huge table to fill, and so I tracked down a welding supply company and figured out the name of the goggles that you always see steampunks wearing now, which is called iCup goggles. Tracked down a welding company that still made them, and started ordering cases of them to sell at conventions. And we brought them pretty cheap, because you know they're kind of like these old style of welding goggles that no one who welded used anymore. And they were happy to get rid of them. And so much so that they actually sent the company that we were buying them from actually sent a representative over to the offices to have a little meeting with us to try and sell us on some of these other more modern welding materials that they sell, you know. But we kept saying no, we just want the goggles. We take them to, he says, so you guys do a lot of welding, huh? No, we take them to science fiction conventions, we repackage them, and we sell them to science fiction fans and steampunk fans, and make a nice profit off of it. And they go, oh, so they do a lot of welding then.
Well, no.
Like, no.
That's like when I was going to Home Depot to try and build a lightsaber.
Was it you or Phil who drew the goggles and the top hats?
Because who decided to put the goggles on the top hats?
In the art. Because
who decided to put that in the comic?
Well, I don't think that actually appears anywhere in Girl Genius.
No, it does.
It is. Sure. If you look in the comic, there's the whole reason I told Phil this, goggles on the top hat are totally Girl Genius's fault. No, really, it is. Because it's the imagery in the comic of the goggles on the top hats that sparked it, because I don't think we've broached this subject, but Girl Genius is one of the, like, zeros.
It's one of the core founding things of modern steampunk.
Mm-hmm.
And the goggles on the top hat is totally Girl Genius's fault.
Yeah, completely.
And you
I like how you're irate.
It's possible, you know, I seem to maybe recall telling somebody that they could put them there while selling them to them at conventions, because they wanted the goggles, but they were... you know, they hurt when you wear them for too long if you haven't broken in the elastic yet. So I said, well, you can just use it as a hat band until it breaks it, until it's breaking out. It's nice, Cheyenne. And loose. So that might be me.
Anybody listening to this, if you have a very nice top hat, like an expensive felt top hat, do not put an elastic band goggle around it. Destroys the hat. After a year or two, it destroys the felt. So anybody listening to this, here's your like one fashion tip from me. Yeah. If you want to do it, just don't leave it on there forever. Take it off.
Evelyn, I'm curious how you have promoted the steampunk movement here, because Matt has talked you up as somebody who's good at
my involvement in this whole thing. Is I'm the person that got it in New York Times, MTV, San Francisco Chronicle, and a whole bunch of other media. I'm kind of one of the people behind the curtain that got a lot of the ball rolling on this. And my whole reasoning behind that is I've been involved with this stuff since late 90s, early 2000s, because a large number of my friends were artists that would fall under this umbrella. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them I would like to see continue doing the art that they're doing. My involvement is basically, I've been involved with the fashion aspect of this forever. I have a steampunk fashion book coming out from Fox Chapel Press in like late 2013, early 2014. It's going to be loaded with like tons of fantastic photos. I've gotten profiles and interviews with people that you won't see anywhere else. And
very cool.
It's a lot of good. And it's basically the 10 years of my work shown in a book. Ruth contacted me. And what had happened is she'd come across steampunk online, kind of. She saw some of the tech stuff, and then she did a little digging and found the fashion aspect of it. Went saying, hey, you know, I'm interested to see if there's more things about the steampunk fashion thing. Can you come and meet with me? So that week I like put together literally everything there was in a huge portfolio thing. And I like contacted a bunch of companies that I'd been working with saying, you know, 6 months ago I talked to you about steampunk and you said you might be doing a line or clothing line. And they're like, yeah, we talked to you. And I was like, do you guys have any like samples or prototypes that I can show her to show that this is actually coming up? And they're like, yeah. So my mailbox exploded with like tons of sketches and drawings of the fashion lines that then later came out in 2009 or 2010. And I honestly expect, I'm talking about the New York Times article, which was the first mainstream coverage of steampunk as a movement or as a fashion anything. And when it was all done, I honestly expected it to be like a tiny, like a quarter page thing. But no, it was like the front page of the New York Times style and fashion section. And then 3 pages in another 2-page spread. So it was like this huge coverage. Nice. And then after that, MTV happened. And then after that, like tons of other media happened. And I ended up being like Rome for a lot of things. Basically, the first couple of years of this, the media really just wanted to focus on the fashion. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the mainstream big companies got involved, and now they're focusing on everything. And that'll hopefully continue so more artists can get work.
And JD, you've been writing about this for a while.
Yeah, so steampunk's one of the genres that I write in. And of course, 19th century technological history is one of the topics that I study. So when the 2000s era of steampunk was sort of building up, and when there was a fan base growing and people were getting involved in it, I would, you know, I'd answer questions about what it was, because I wrote it and I you know, studied stuff related to it. And it got to the point where I ended up writing articles on various topics, just trying to do sort of blanket coverage of stuff to make it really easy for people. And actually my steampunk 101, which was like a synthesis of a bunch of it, is to date the most widely referenced, quoted, and resourced nonfiction article on the subject of steampunk. And it's been reproduced in a bunch of books, and I'm very excited about that, because hopefully it's helping people out. But because of the, you know, sort of the articles that I did, and just, you know, because I answer questions and because of my writing, events started asking me to, you know, steampunk events that were starting up asked me to come out as a guest and be on panels. And the big thing they want me to do is lectures. I almost always do this steampunk 101 lecture, which is, I mean, it's a lot of fun. I really love doing it. And it's great to get the questions people have and answer them. Mm-hmm. But it's like every single time I make an appearance, no matter what else I'm doing, it's like I am doing that lecture in addition to everything else. So when you're talking earlier, I won't lecture at you, but if you want to, I totally can. But yeah, so that's basically what it is. I write both fiction and nonfiction, and steampunk fans seem to enjoy it.
And you're also the picture.
Yes, I am apparently. I'm apparently Wikipedia's picture for steampunk.
You've been on the front page of Wikipedia like twice on your birthday. I think that's hilarious.
It's on my birthday. There is a picture of me on Wikipedia, and it's like, what, four-year-old picture or something like that, but it's
3 years old
on Wikipedia.
This picture is the iconic.
It's like starred or something, where it's like, you know, that's like their best example of whatever the topic is. So apparently it's the best example of both steampunk and me.
Well, you're a very snappy dresser.
Well, you know, what kind of stuff is. But, and yeah, the thing that I really love so much about doing all this is getting to meet the fans and getting to talk to them and getting to, you know, hear their thoughts and see what their questions are and you know, hopefully answer their questions or help them think about things, help them answer their own questions.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
Because I think it's just really a great experience.
So what does each of you have coming up?
I am the colorist for Girl Genius, which is a steampunk graphic novel series, which you can read for free, absolutely for free.
No way.
At girlgenius.net. We put up a new page every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. The entirety of the graphic novel run is there. It will not cost you a dime. At least that's what we say.
Here's a little factual note. One of our first interviews was with you guys, in which the interview crashed and it has never aired.
Yep.
The only interview that has never aired on Geeks On is the one that we did with you and Phil.
Yep. And it was really good.
It was a good one.
It was
at Comic-Con in like 2006.
So it's basically the premise of the comic is we try to capture the feel of adventure, romance, and mad science. It's about our female lead is a woman by the name of Agatha Heterdyne, who has recently discovered that she is the long lost heir of a very powerful mad scientist family. This takes place in a sort of alternate reality, Europe, sometime after the Napoleonic era, or right around the Napoleonic era, and in which the entire all of Europe is run not by kings or by political parties. It is run by mad scientists, and those whose science is the strongest rule. And Agatha's family is one of the most horrific practitioners of mad scientists for 1,000 years. They're called the Heterodynes, and they were feared and loathed all over Europe. They're most bloodthirsty and ruthless scientists that ever walked across the Carpathians. But in one generation, her father and his brother managed to change everyone's opinion of the Heterodynes, because born to the Heterodynes were the two of the most prolific heroes, the people who reined in the science, who fought back the monsters, and then vanished. Their castle was destroyed, their lands fell to other scientists, and the only heir was believed dead. But now, as you know from how I started this, she's back. She's 18 years old, and she's ready to reclaim the throne of the Heterodynes. But everyone is worried that will she be like her father, a hero, or will she be like every other Heterodyne before them and be a horrible monster? And so people either are rising up to either help her or stand in her way or try and control her, and she has to fight for her birthright and decide who she's going to be.
Very cool. Now, if after reading some of these free pages online, there is a way of getting back issues, is that true?
Yes.
We could start from the beginning.
The weird thing, and the economy of comics as they are, is that comic books don't really make you any money. They basically serve as advertisement for your work. Mm-hmm. A small, 36-page comic book that you see in the store comes in and it's sold out and it's gone. But graphic novels, they live on forever. We print collections of graphic novels, which we can sell off of our website and off of Amazon. You can buy them either way. We still make money off of them. So we print trade collections of all the stories, and we actually just last year have made a deal with Tor Books, and they're beginning to print collections of the graphic novels, collections of the collections actually. Great. And so you can buy them from Tor Books, you can buy them from Amazon, you can buy them from our own website. All that money that you spend on that pays for us to live in our wealth and opulence, surrounded by all our stuff, and helps us produce more pages every Monday and Wednesday and Friday for free at girlgenius.net.
You guys have pins.
Yes, I also, one of the things I've been having fun is I've been designing pins for law enforcement agencies that never existed. And I designed the Tesla Ranger pin, which you can get off of our website, the Adventure Society pin. And after I made those two, I realized I needed to make a pin badge design for a villains organization, just to, so that the Tesla Rangers and the Adventure Society members had someone to fight. So I made up Faust, the Fraternal Alliance of Unethical Steam Technologists, which is a lovely little skull and monocle pin with a little with a curly villain's mustache on it. And
you've got to go online.
It's so much fun to actually be walking around conventions and to see people who have no idea who I am wearing the stuff I designed. And it's actually quite thrilling. It's a lot of fun.
It's a very flattering experience, and I love the fans for their dedication. I would ask that I have a small amount of personal space after I have finished with a panel, just because I usually need to get a drink of water because my voice isn't working at that point. You know, and it's great. I mean, it is really, I think we all agree, it's wonderful to be able to positively affect people in this way. I think it's absolutely fantastic.
Well, we really appreciate you three for joining us and, you know, explaining all this. I mean, to have you guys here, I think introducing...
A lot of people, too.
Yeah, I mean, we have, the people who listen to us are a bunch of geeks, and a lot of them have heard, of course, steampunk. But even kind of just knowing just the passing of it is different than kind of digging in, and you guys did a really good job of explaining it.
Getting a little more immersed.
But before we leave...
We got a little bit.
We have a little thing to leave you with.
A little bit. Now the Geeks On podcast is known for this technobabble that we've done. Now, it was originally honored because of Star Trek, where basically there would be a problem on whatever various ship, and they would, Geordi LaForge or Scotty or whoever, would come up with this vast amount of technobabble.
To magically get them out of some spot.
Exactly. I'll explain the situation. So I thought for our steampunk episode, since steampunk largely revolves around inventors and the machines they invent, why not do a steampunk technobabble where you come up with your steampunk inventor and the crazy steampunk technology that they invent. So that is what we're doing here. Here's our steampunk technobabble.
Do you want me to start since this is Aaron?
Yeah, go.
I'll
go
start
small
because
we'll
I'm not good at this.
Better than me.
I don't know steampunk too well, so I'm going to give it a shot here, and then I'll leave it to you professionals here.
All right.
I'm going to do this as the voice of
the voice. Okay.
I am Sir Helge Waldock II. I've been accused of being a fanatical explorer, hell bent on finding gold and diamond crusted cities hidden deep within the dark continent. Rubbish. I believe the true wealth of Africa is not hidden at all. Botany. That's where the true wealth is. Thousands of new and exciting botanical specimens waiting to unlock scientific secrets. But traveling jungles, twisted, tangled, is downright curlish. So I've invented the Iron Horse. Four legs, iron skin, box camera, and powered by my ingenious high-temperature vapor piston flywheel. We're experimenting with wireless telegraph as well, based off of Hertz's good work with the spark gap transmitter. With clockwork precision, my inertial batteries have only 0.32 energy loss. I can trot around the primeval forests for days before needing to feed this beast with fire. Oh, and to see the faces of those godless primitives as I approach is priceless. All right, that's all I got.
I thought that was pretty good.
That's pretty good.
I didn't have much techno babble, though.
I'm suck at this.
Oh, God.
You want me to go?
All right.
Yeah, be good. Okay. I don't know.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I interest you in the latest technological marvel created by that pinnacle of intellect, Dr. Victor Zagreb? Now, as you may know, Victor Zagreb's previous examples of fantastical advancement of scientific technology have met with slight complications. His device for light-powered telegraphy did have an unfortunate side effect of setting fire to anything that the beam of light happened to touch, but I assure you that his latest device will produce no such effect. You have, of course, heard of the ice box, which is a box that has ice. What a peculiar name. But can you imagine a self-icing ice box? Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Zagreb has created a room approximately 13 feet in either direction, five stories tall, and filled more than three quarters with pieces of equipment, that is able to turn the very atmosphere itself into a thin layer of ice. Now, how does it accomplish this? Now, you may think that there are fantastical, amazing, etheric forces at work, but I assure you it is simple electricity, which is enacting in some sort of manner to produce a giant gust of hot air blowing outside. So long as you stay away from this, you'll be completely unharmed. Now, after numerous tests involving dead chickens, we have confirmed that this self-icing icebox has been able to maintain temperatures of very nearly 40 degrees Celsius for a period of up to 15 minutes, after which point it overheats and begins to catch fire and explode. But ladies and gentlemen, I can assure you that it is perfectly safe, because if you have ice cream, which you have bought from your local ice cream seller, and you need a place to store it, if you place it in the self-icing icebox, you will presumably not want to keep it there for more than about 5 or 10 minutes. And ladies and gentlemen, what do I hear? Now, of course, you would say, oh, I would pay $15,000 for it. I would even pay $10,000. Well, you're in luck. It is, in fact, $25,000. Now, don't all rush off to the bank at once. Where are you all going?
Excellent.
All right. Well, I'll go.
Okay, Matt's going to go.
All right. Mine's done more as a historical.
After the end of the Steam Wars, a single man rose to prominence. Duke Hunald Agenia Gallifer Seguin Lop III. A man of vast wealth and simple tastes, he ruled over the small European nation of Esconia. They lived in peace for 23 years, till war returned to their lives. The neighboring nation of Navarre had suffered a seven-year drought. The resulting famine brought the Grey Party to power. They convinced their people that it was in their best interest to invade the prosperous and quiet Vasconia. Overnight, the gentle hamlets of Vasconia were turned into a nightmare as the Grey marched through their simple defenses as if they were made of so much cheesecloth. Duke Hunald brought the country's aging war machine back into the battle, but was routed in every exchange. And so he retreated into his workshop and began to create. A creation born of desperation and need. And as such, he never asked the question, should this thing be born at all? For what he wrought in that dungeon as the hail bombs burst around his castle was almost worse than anything the Grey could wreak on his people. He began by cracking his own soul in twain, and with dark bindings stitched it into a form of flesh, wire, and steel. He created the mercuric anodyne process, which, of course, we now use for all of our etheric method, so we may thank him for that, but he used it to fuse organic to metallic carbon to things beyond the veil. He used trances and glyphs, great gleaming ether beams, and dark rituals of the Corbraith Thurin. And out of it was born the Kaer Thanach, the fire spitter, and it cut through the Grey, consuming the souls of friend and foe alike. And at first, Duke Hunald was praised as a hero, the savior of the Vascons everywhere, till he tried to stop the thing. And it looked through the lens of their shared soul and laughed in his face. It is said now that the Grey Wars were the inception of the blight that covers Vascon and Navarre. But those of us who know and study know that it is the Kaer Thanach and its never-ending hunger that feeds and grows in that dark land.
Nice. There was a lot of babble in there.
Yes, it was.
That was a lot of babble.
That was very deep in the battle.
All right.
Well, we here at Transylvania Polygnostic are pleased to announce the unveiling of our very nearly perfected automatic grading engine. The automatic grading engine handily eliminates all of the time-consuming and tedious work of actually paying attention to and evaluating a student's work, and frees up your professor for really important things, like faculty airship racing, tea parties, and tenure death duels. Naturally, the entire faculty is very excited and couldn't wait to try it out. Hence your receipt of this document at the beginning of the term instead of at the end, as is traditional. Should you find yourself given poor marks or marks in a class that you did not in fact register for, please be assured that the automatic grading engine is the product of our great university's brightest minds and the very pinnacle of modern science. In the event of error, the fault must surely be yours. Students who fail to produce grade results corresponding to the engine's predictions will be considered troublemakers and watched carefully. Now, I have a small sampling of some of our attendees' reports here. I will just go over the highlights and the lowlights. Peter, your SOAC 232 statistics class, you will be receiving an A-. Student excels in writing original stories. At your engineering 213, modern airship design, you will be required to earn yourself a C. Student consistently sacrifices accuracy for unnecessary speed. Matt, your biology 383, graveyard reconnaissance, A-, has a sense of humor that we all enjoy. Physics 404, introduction to transdimensional harmonics, D. Student asks rather a lot of questions. And Aaron, your physics 322, introduction to invisibility, A. Student frequently fails to appear in class.
Nice.
And physics 224, quantum phys ed, C-. Mature vocabulary, very well documented. All right, Mr. Marshall. Philosophy 301, personal values versus the common good. A+. Students' attempts to bribe the instructor are encouraging. And philosophy 101, things man was not meant to know. F. Cries easily.
Nice. That's great.
I may have to turn that into a short.
Yeah, that would be a real fantastic short film. Yeah. Okay, is that everybody?
I think that's it. I think we have closed out Steampunk. For more information on any one of our folks, give me your websites, Cheyenne.
Oh, well, girlgenius.net. For all your girl genius needs. If you'd like to see some of my illustrations, my website is arcanetimes.com.
Evelyn?
Evelyn Crete. If you want to see my website, you can go to jabberwocky.net.
I spell it
weirdly because I'm special. And it's jabberwhalky.net. And basically that spelling is me online for the last, 16 years.
GD?
It is gdfalkson.com. That is G-D-F-A-L-K-S-E-N, because I am Danish.
This will also be on our website links, and we're going to splash it all over our Facebook page and any other, well,
wherever we can.
Yeah, we'll tweet it.
Heck, why not?
It'll be in at least 3 or 4 bathroom stalls, in the Los Angeles area.
For a good time, call Cheyenne Wright.
Well, thank you very much again.
Cheyenne!
Had a blast. Hope you guys actually can join us again.
You guys are awesome.
For other topics.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, and have a good night.
Rock it out.
All right.
Geek it out.